From the Cyber Hub bunker and studio, you're tuning in to the Cyber Hub podcast. And now for your host and CISO, James Azar.
Mr. Fulone, happy Friday, brother.
Happy Friday.
So for everyone tuning in, good morning. Welcome to the Two CISOs Talking Cyber kind of segment that Chris and I were like, you know what we should do? We should do something. And we decided to do this. It's really random.
Well, before you go any further, don't forget to raise your cup and have some good coffee.
I've got my double espresso here. I love me a good coffee in the morning, especially on a Friday. Because, like, you know, you're ready for the weekend on a Friday. Like, I really believe we should. I'd rather work 4 days a week for 11 hours than work 5 days a week for 8.
Hmm. I agree. I much prefer to have, like, Fridays as my long weekend whenever possible.
Indeed. Well, it's great to have everyone tuning in this morning. We've been talking about Zero Trust. We took a break last week, unfortunately, because I was traveling. I was airborne on Friday, and so we couldn't pre-record. Chris is busy doing what Chris does, which is his coaching business, which you guys should definitely, if you're looking for help, you should talk to Chris about it. And my full-time job had me traveling a lot last week. Like, I did like 5 or 6 flight segments last week. Like, it was crazy. And so all in all, we're back at it. We've been talking Zero Trust for quite some time. So today we're talking about least privilege. And so having said that, Chris, I'll give you opening statement on Zero Trust least privilege principles. What's your take?
Well, I'd say for Zero Trust least privilege, this is something that many might do outside of Zero Trust when you think of role-based access control, identity and access management, integrating multi-factor authentication, things like that, because those are some of the things that you might do as part of your day-to-day where you're limiting the privilege that someone might have within the environment to only do the things that you want them to do. So, for example, you will have an administrator that doesn't need access into, say, production tenants unless they have a ticket to investigate. Then you create some just-in-time privileges, you get them access, they can work in the environment. Then those privileges spin down. That's how you do just-in-time least privilege in a sustainable way. There's, of course, many different ways to approach it, and some look at it like a egg and chicken situation, but you just have to sit back and... Why are you poo-pooing this, James?
It's so weird.
Like, your screen is like giving me
thumbs. I'm doing this with my thumbs, and somehow the camera's like, are you giving us a thumbs down? No, everything you're saying is spot on. I'm not giving you a thumbs down. I don't know what's wrong with this camera. This is AI for everyone. AI trying to read my emotions. Can't read my emotions. The U.S. government paid top dollar to make sure I show none.
But yeah, so that's the principle of how you can implement and use least privilege within the environment. It sounds easy, but you really have to think through how your environment functions, how your services functions, how you can create permissions for them that give them only what they need and not anything more. Because under the cuspus of least privilege, you don't want to give a service account domain admin just because the vendor asked for it. Go ahead.
Yeah. So let me kind of interrupt you for just a moment and say, you're talking about kind of the execution. I'm going to go granular for just a moment, if that's okay. So the idea of least privilege is what many people see. If you go through LinkedIn and you go through kind of like their new concept of people putting in, like, what do you think of least privilege and what are all the ways? And they put, get, let everyone contribute an idea and you become a top voice. That's a way for LinkedIn to kind of give people top voices and stuff like that. So all of that's really, really cool. But when you read that, and I read that prior to doing this episode, I get that people know what least privilege is, but have no real way to understand how to properly execute it. And this is going to go back to something we talked about several weeks ago as part of our NIST CSF discussion and some of the early conversations Chris and I had, right? There's a, if you're going to go down the path of least privilege and zero trust, you know, a lot of people will say we practice parts of zero trust, but we don't do everything. And unfortunately, zero trust has no gray area. If you decide to become a zero trust type of organization, you're either drinking the entire Kool-Aid or you're not drinking it at all. You can't say I'm going to have half of the Kool-Aid and not do the other half there, because all you're doing is you're creating your own security gaps in your environment by not adopting it completely. Yeah, and some exactly. people disagree with me, and that's okay. But I'm willing to debate that on any stage, anywhere, with anyone. You're either all in or you're not. With the NIST CSF, you could be all in or you could be not. You could adopt bits and pieces of it because it's designed very differently from zero trust. Zero trust is a way of life. I'm on keto. I've lost 12 pounds since I started keto a month ago, right? It's a way of life. I can't say, all right, I'm on keto Monday, but then I'm eating hamburgers and fries and pizza on Tuesday. Doesn't work. It fails miserably. And I'll get to how we get to the granular aspect of this. The idea of least privilege comes from, first of all, you as a security practitioner, CISO, VP, or analyst, or even an IM person, right? You've got to workshop this. You've got to know, what does every side of the business do? What are all the accesses and all the type of data they need access to? What SaaS applications do they need access to? Now, what's the minimum they need in every single one of those in order to effectively do their job while not introducing new risk to the business? And these are done in building relationships with those teams, meaning you're going out to those teams and you're literally workshopping this, going, all right, tell me everything everyone on the team uses. We use SharePoint. We use Teams. All of our data is in our Oracle ERP system. We access Snowflake for some database. We're on HubSpot for customer service, whatever it is, right? And I can keep naming and naming things. Okay, now tell me role by role. Tell me a day in the life of you, you know, Mr. Engineer, or you, Mr. Customer Service Representative, or you, Mr. FP&A in accounting. Tell me a day in your life. Share with me what a day looks like. Give them 10 minutes. Hear them out.
The problem with that is, even if you hear them out in a user session just for that one day, they might not understand the implementation complexity of what's required. They might not understand that while 80% of their role is covered by what they do day to day, but this extra 20% that they take for granted, no, this is an escalated new role that needs to be created so that they could do that, so that they could print that check, so that they could approve that general ledger. All these things that it's part of their day-to-day job, they take for granted. But when you look at it in the scope of the application, these are now sensitive things that you're doing that you don't want everyone to do. Like, you don't want everyone to be able to print checks and to validate that this check lines up to this payment. Otherwise, you'd have a lot of inside people printing checks to facetious companies and just putting it in their back pocket. I'm not saying everyone would do it, but it would enable that type of environment. The next thing is, people's roles will change and adjust every quarter based on new software, new ways to do it, because the provider now said, oh, well, we made some adjustments in the roles and we kind of combined some of the activities here. Now you have to go back, reevaluate how the role is set up, and make sure that the folks that have that role are still able to do their business functions with the roles that they have assigned.
Yeah, so completely agree with that. User sessions are important. Defining the user session is critically important. Explaining to someone that we're doing a user session to better understand what you're doing throughout the day, and then tell me the things that you're doing maybe once a month or once a quarter to better understand that. Again, if you run user sessions, you know, you're trying to get as much out of the group you're working with in about an hour to 90 minutes, because you can't do it for any longer. And then you're mapping that to the actual data you have on the work they do. Meaning, if you're not cross-referencing the stuff they say with the data and access they have currently at the moment before you implement this, you're really only getting one side of the story. The side of the story should always be supported with a, you know, the physical data, you know, the real hard data of someone looking at their logs and seeing what are they accessing, where do they spend a lot of time, you know, what's their screen time on? Is their screen time on Outlook, right? Or are they browser based? Because this goes into the different discussion, which I think in least privilege is often not very much looked at, but really important, is because we live in a SaaS world today. And we live in it as a service. A lot of stuff is browser based, right? And so we don't live in the world 10 years ago where everyone could, you know, I feel like practicing security 10 years ago was a lot easier. You can't download anything on your device because everything was an application. Everything was an icon, right? On your desktop. And that's how you launched everything. And today we live in a world where everything is single sign-on, right? And everything is SaaS based, and you no longer have that control, because I can open my browser and pretty much go anywhere unless you're limiting my browser. And I think this is where, like, you know, browser extensions come into play. And I think that's why they've been so darn successful, is because, you know, some companies tell their employees you can only use Edge or Chrome or whatever. But I sometimes like to use Brave or Safari or DuckDuckGo. And with these extensions, you're able to tell someone you can use any browser you want as long as it has these extensions. And these extensions give you that layer of security on top of the data. And then you're able to actually get the data you need to properly implement least privilege without being the guy that everyone screams at the water cooler or on the happy hour. You ever see security guys like try to give a presentation on Teams or Slack in one of those like big company happy hours, and they're talking about a project they worked on, and you can tell, like, if you look at the other chats that are going on that are not the direct chats of that meeting, people are like, this is the person responsible for my misery.
But I wanted to go back to something you mentioned earlier. Initially, we were talking about like roles and role-based access permissions in the form of how do they access applications. You mentioned the word data, and I think that's a whole pillar of least privilege that many people overlook when they're doing their provisioning, is who in the organization needs to get access to this W3 bucket? Who in the organization needs to get access to this database? And what level of access do they need to get? And these are the questions that often get overlooked when it comes to this conversation, because least privilege is not just a entitlement for an application or being able to use an application. It should include everything from the application, the network that they get access to, and the types of data that they get access to. Now, that presents a lot of additional analysis for the security agent that's doing this analysis, because now they have to look at the data and who's using the data, why they're using the data, and are they using the data for the good of the organization, or are they trying to extract it for their next role? I mean, these are the types of things you have to think through. Worst case scenario, best case scenario, and then what can we do to mitigate it if it was the worst case scenario? How do we get alerting on this? How do we remediate on this? All these little things that many people overlook when it comes to being able to control access to the data.
Yeah, I think, you know, you bring up such a great point, Chris. How do people get access to data? What kind of data do they access? What's natural progression of data? And this is where, you know, generative AI really does come in to help you with least privilege, right? I mean, I think that's the next iteration of what I'd like to see from least privilege. I did something back in, not in my current role, but in the role before that when I was at the bank, where we used Transmit Security to identify, and Transmit had a fraud detection tool that was AI powered, not generative AI powered, but AI powered. And there's a difference. We're not going to get into it on this show, but we can have that in the future. But it would look at what would be typical consumer behavior with a bank based on, you know, account status, how much money you've got, how you interact with the app, and so forth. And if you, for example, always hold your phone in your left hand, and all of a sudden you're holding it in your right hand, and you're trying to do like small, you know, $100 transactions, and you're doing them all over to all these accounts, we consider that to be suspicious. One, because it's not your normal behavior. So either someone's doing it for you, or you're doing it for someone, or someone stole your phone and someone has hijacked your account, right? Now, mind you, we were passwordless to begin with because of how we implemented Transmit Security. So and this is not internal, this is external, y'all. So least privilege, we always kind of seem to be focused on our internal employees. But if you have end users that access your environment, and what I mean by that is customers, well, the least privilege rules apply to your customers as well. What's the exact amount of information your customer needs to access without putting your customer or your business at risk by giving them that access? And that's a harder exercise to do because every customer feels they're entitled to everything. However, the everything creates a significant risk in the event you fall for a credential attack and your customers are taken advantage of. And so we did this exercise on the customer side of least privilege, and we did it with Transmit Security, and it was amazing. Now, not given, I'm only saying their name because I use them. I'm a fan of the product, right? I'm not getting paid or anything. I mean, you know, if Mickey wants to send me a check, I'll gladly take it. But but the way we implemented that product to look at human behavior was important. Now, the company went out of business before we were able to do that internally, because we were going to take the same exact thing that we were using outward to identify fraud behavior from customers, because that was a greater risk than internal fraud, and then apply that internally to all of our employees, meaning how do they interact with their application once we go all passwordless internally, right? Once they sign in through their devices, once they're authenticated, once through their devices, we were setting rules. If you're trying to get access to data, why are you getting access to this data? We'd drop you a notification and you'd have to biometrically authenticate that it's you asking for the data. Right now, that's on the employee level. Now let's go access least privilege on the non-human layer of least privilege, because there's the human layer Then there's the non-human layers. Those are your APIs, your third-party connections, everything else. We were looking at how do we deploy that on non-human aspects of the environment. So when you think of non-human, you go, well, how would I give an API least privilege? You would very much limit the API in the data it can get, and then you would tokenize a lot of that data in that API, especially through the tunnels that you're building. So you'd make sure it's an HTTPS API, not an HTTP, number one. Common sense, basic OWASP rules, but you won't believe how many of them still have HTTP. Go talk to Chuck Herring over at Wib now F5, because Wib got acquired by F5, and congratulations to them. He'll tell you all about it. I love Chuck. Chuck was one of my mentors. Great, great individual. And so how many of them don't use that, or they don't, and then they're not putting DLP on their non-human endpoints. So now you've got data flowing back and forth, and it could be non-tokenized data. And now you're wondering, what am I doing? And so you've got to be able to look at least privilege in a few different ways. There's the human aspect, internal employees. There's the human aspect, your customers. And then there's the non-human, internal and external non-human identities that are trying to access your environment. Chris, am I boring you?
No, absolutely.
Does that make sense, Bubba?
you make sense. I was just letting you finish. But when you think of service accounts, one of the first things that you have to do is you can't grant those service accounts full admin access, even though it might be the easy thing to do. No, you need to scope out the rights and permissions of those service accounts, of those APIs, as to what data can they access, what data can they transmit, and then along the way, have gateways. So from internal APIs to external APIs, maybe you have a little spot check there. Make sure that the right type of information is going along those APIs, that the right type of protection is being enabled on those APIs, and the data is going from the right place to the right place. Oftentimes, threat actors will take advantage of API gateways and redirect them, but because it's going through an API gateway, your network defenders often overlook what's kind of passing through those tunnels. So from a component of least privilege, that's something that you need to understand. You need to create those different levels of access. And if they need higher level, create challenges for them. Maybe it's a CAPTCHA, maybe it's a MFA token, maybe it's a physical MFA token, because now you're going into the bank vault or a critical system for the bank, and a regular MFA won't work. No, for these, we want a hardware token that only one of it exists, something like that. The other thing that you want to do is really cut down on any generic broad access controls that you might have given, and instead opt for just-in-time access. That's for right. Systems. If a user hasn't used a system on a daily basis for this elevated privilege, that's a perfect use case for them to be able to request just-in-time access. And you can have automated flows where you'll give them the next level up automatically, but they just have to request it and have a business use case. And that business use case, while they might seem like it's trivial, it's being logged. It's being logged so that when you do go back and you do forensics, if you typed in that you needed it for this reason, it's logged there. And then you can go back to that stakeholder and go, well, this was the reason that you requested just-in-time access, and you got it. Other times, it has to be tied to an actual incident. And the just-in-time access system will validate that you are an incident responder, that you are assigned to this incident response ticket. And if those two things are not true, you don't get that extra level of permission that you need. Because oftentimes, I've seen in my world where people use tickets and they do ticket surfing when they're trying to get escalated rights. They'll find any incident response ticket or any escalated ticket, and they'll just surf on that to get their escalated rights. That is unfortunately a vulnerability that you have to close down. You can't allow that to happen. And you should audit for that and find the folks that are doing that and explain to them why this isn't the right way to do it.
Yeah, I would say one thing is, whenever you're doing least privilege, your identity access management, your IAM audits and your IAM reviews become critically important as part of that process. So I know we're at 28 minutes. We've got a few minutes left. I want to kind of summarize this so that everyone who's listening or watching can take actionable items back with them. So first of all, I think the first one, understand your company and understand your business. Understand the different departments in your company. Know how the company makes money, but then understand how the different departments support the company's revenue and expense efforts. Identify your greater risk teams and then start with your greater risk teams. Do human workshops backed up by actual log data. Meaning just because you speak to someone and say, I need all this, whenever you speak to anyone, anywhere, I need all this access all the time. No one needs all the access all the time. So you've got to really go into these workshops hyper-focused on asking the right questions and not general questions. Like, tell me, you know, a great conversation starter is, tell me about a day in the life of Chris. Chris will go, well, I come in, I make my coffee, I log into my systems, I launch Okta or whatever it is that I'm using, I log into all the different applications, I review emails, I do all these things, wonderful, great, magnificent, and then start to kind of hone in on every single aspect of their work. How often are you interacting with customers or financial data or healthcare data or payment data or whatever it is? And kind of start to identify what are your crown jewels of the data you really want to defend and understand how they interact with what you consider to be your data rules. And you can't go into least privilege without having your data classification done, without having your complete understanding of managing all of these SaaS environments properly and effectively and making sure you've got good DLP and so forth, because otherwise, you know, you're just, again, you know, chicken or egg, what came first? Well, you know, we can debate that over and over again, but you got to have some more. You can't start zero trust at least privilege is what I'm saying, right? Like, that can't be your first ticket item in your zero trust journey. It's got to be somewhere in the middle of that journey, depending on the type of business you've got. So we'll put that there. You want to do your audits, you want to grab your data, and then you want to start by doing your test implementations. You want to look at systems that can support least privilege, just-in-time access, role-based access control, automated workflows to ensure that, you know, someone doesn't have to submit a ticket at 6:30 p.m. on a Tuesday and not get approved until Wednesday morning because, you know, or Thursday morning or Friday morning because, you know, whatever. Got to make sure that if someone needs access in the next 10 minutes, you're able to grant them access in the next 10 minutes. Very simple. And the decision's got to be binary. There's a decision tree to make. Yes, no. So that's kind of a good summary of this. Anything to add to that summary, Chris?
That's your first step. As soon as you hit a secondary application, a second data store, now you have a snowflake fractal area that you now have to follow off of and decide, does that play within the same least privilege boundary, or is this a separate analysis that you need to do? Because you can have multiple levels of zero trust from different applications or four different pieces of data, and you have to do that analysis independently. So the help desk might need access to their ticketing system, their ticketing database by default, but then sometimes they need access to Active Directory. They might not need that all the time. So they might have their regular user, and then they have a privileged user that they will request access as they need it to go do something like reset a user's password or change and something within their credentials. But that's a separate least privileged conversation that you need to have. And you kind of just use each session to create a next dot that you're going to connect it to. And eventually you can do that and go through the entire organization. It's not going to be a one user workshop session and you're going to get everything. This is a continuous process, a continuous journey. So don't expect this to happen overnight. This is part of a continuous improvement process overall for your organization.
I love it. Thank you, everyone, for watching us this morning. We really appreciate y'all spending a Friday morning with Chris and myself. You can learn more about me and Chris in the show notes, by the way, below our LinkedIn pages, our Substacks. Chris does a lot of writing on Substack. So do I. You can check that out. You can go check out CPF Coaching. If you're looking for mentorship and coaching in cybersecurity, Chris absolutely does that. And that's one of his passions as a security practitioner. So make sure to go and check that out. And thank y'all. Have a great, great weekend. It's the Jewish holiday of Purim, Chris, by the way. So, costume parties all weekend long.
I didn't know that, but I'd add some of the other services that I do is I help small, medium-sized businesses with their security assessments so that they could respond better to their upstream security requests from their vendors, and they can improve their security maturity process, which oftentimes most SMBs don't have. And I love help coaching them in that process.
Brilliant. Well, now you know everything about myself and Chris. Go check that out. If you want to support any one of us, the best way to do that is go subscribe to our Substack. Follow our podcast as well, Breaking Into Cybersecurity for Chris, and then my CyberHub podcast, which you're tuning into now. Till then, thank you all for tuning in. Have a great, great weekend. Enjoy the long, nice weekend. And most importantly, stay cyber safe, y'all. Thanks.
Thanks, all.
We love feedback, so make sure to connect with us on social media and subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast listening platform.